man is born to trouble as sparks fly upward. That's just part of life, isn't it? Sometimes stuff comes up. It's hard. Comes to you in all sorts of circumstances. Sometimes it's your work or your lack of work. Sometimes it's centered on other people. Someone has made himself or herself your enemy. You have friction in a relationship. Maybe someone is behaving treacherously, betraying you. Maybe there's deception, and so the people issues become really, really difficult. There might even be violence. Sometimes it's a health issue that brings on the trouble. You're going along fine, but now there's a problem you've never had before, or there's news you didn't expect to get. Sometimes it's just the uncertainty, and I think there's a lot of that in our society today. There's so much uncertainty about the future, about jobs, about the economy, about whether I'll ever be able to sell this house, or whether it's worth what I paid for it 10 or 15 years ago. There's just a lot that can unsettle a person. And so this morning, I want you to think with me about a righteous response to trouble. A righteous response to trouble. We can't do anything about the trouble. There's going to be times, there are going to be times like that. But how are we supposed to respond when something happens? How does a righteous person face problems? Well, we get a wonderful example of a righteous response to trouble in Psalm 142, which is where I want us to be this morning. Psalm 142. We'll read that in just a moment. This particular psalm is an example of how the righteous respond to trouble, and the trouble in this psalm is people trouble. This is how we respond, but the prompt here is treachery and betrayal and violence. Now, part of the heading in your Bible is actually the scripture. You probably have another heading that is inserted by the translators to help you find things. That's usually in a different typeface. Most Bibles, it's bold and bigger. But there's a portion of this that goes with the original psalm. It's part of the scripture before verse 1. And it says, Maskil of David when he was in the cave. That part that is actually the scripture says that. Maskil is an obscure Hebrew term that probably means something like contemplation. It's possible that it's a musical term, technical term that we've just lost the meaning to. But the rest of this is very plain. It is written by David, and it's written about a time when David was in a cave. Now, we have two examples in Scripture that could be referring to. Derek mentioned these last week when he did Psalm 141. One of those possible reference points is in 1 Samuel 22. The other is in 1 Samuel 24. Both of these times, David was in a cave. Both of these times, David happened to be in the cave because he was fleeing from King Saul, who was trying to kill him. He was in deep trouble. It was trouble that was in the people category. It was extreme trouble. There was a threat of violence and death against him. He had to run for his life. He hid himself in a cave. Now, this is not quite like being concerned that you might not get your bonus this year, although that could cause trouble, especially if you already spent it, then that's a problem. But this is more than that. You know, David's life is actually at stake. All of his hopes and dreams are set aside for an extended period of time, even if he survives. He's still living out in the wilderness. He's not pursuing any of the things he had intended to pursue at that point in his life. Well, how do the righteous respond to trouble like that? This psalm gives us a tremendous example. So let's read it now. Psalm 142, beginning with verse 1. I cry aloud with my voice to the Lord. I make supplication with my voice to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before him. I declare my trouble before him. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, you knew my path. In the way where I walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see, for there is no one who regards me. There is no escape for me. No one cares for my soul. I cried out to you, O Lord. I said, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Give heed to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Bring my soul out of prison, so that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me. Now, it should be clear, even in that brief reading, that this psalm is a prayer. David's response to his trouble is a prayer to the Lord. That's very natural. It's easier to pray when you're in trouble, isn't it? It's a pretty significant prompt to pray. In fact, I would submit to you that even the unrighteous do this. You've probably seen people who have no thought of God day by day, but they suddenly come upon trouble in their lives and they get religion, don't they? If you've ever ministered in a prison, everybody in there has got religion, at least while you're there. You know, you might be able to do something for them, and so they turn it on. People cry out to God in their trouble. The righteous do, but also in some sense the wicked do. And so the thing that distinguishes the response of the righteous is not the fact that the righteous pray, but rather the way in which the righteous pray. There's a difference in this prayer from what a wicked person would do when he or she might just switch on the religion because now I'm desperate and because this might work and I don't want to take any chances. You know, I mean, God might do something for me, and so I want to cover all the bases and I'm going to pray and whatever else. But this isn't like that at all. And so what I want to do this morning is just walk through this prayer and look at the characteristics of this righteous prayer so that we can see how we should respond in times of trouble and what our prayer should be like if we have a problem. And so I want to give you seven characteristics that I see in this righteous prayer. These are characteristics that we can imitate. They're things that we can test our own praying by. They're a way that we can kind of step back from our problems and take a new approach if we're really struggling or if the emotions are really spinning out of control at the moment. So, seven characteristics of righteous prayer. Number one, pray fervently. Pray fervently. Look again at verse 1. David says, I cry aloud with my voice to the Lord. I make supplication with my voice to the Lord. Trouble seems to stir up considerable emotion, bad news, problems, disturbing circumstances. We respond emotionally to all of that kind of stuff. It's just part of the way we're made. But that emotion is not always pointed toward God, is it? Sometimes people respond in self-pity. Sometimes they respond in anger at the circumstance or anger at another person. Most of the feelings that people express in their trouble are not like these feelings expressed here in this psalm. There's an intensity here in this kind of prayer that's pointed toward God, and it indicates that David is turning toward God with all of that emotional energy that the threat of his life produced in him. There's an intensity in this kind of prayer that we should be able to imitate in times of trouble. We should take all of that that's stirred up inside of us and point it toward our relationship with God in prayer. Now, how different is just verse 1, how different is that from the kind of attitude that you might hear in the life of an unrighteous person who turns to God because now I have a problem? I better do this just in case. This might help. David is going to God with all of his energy. He's crying out. It's coming out aloud. I cry out with my voice. He's asking for what he needs. The word supplication in verse 1 means making requests of God. It's the asking part of our praying. David is fervently asking for what he needs. He knows who can help. He's taking all of that energy and he's pointing it toward God and saying, I'm going to work this out with you. That's a righteous response to pray, to trouble. Pray fervently. Number 2, pray intimately. Verse 2 says, I pour out my complaint before him. I declare my troubles before him. Notice that David is complaining to God rather than complaining about God. He's not saying, how could a righteous God let this Saul guy get away for this for so long? Instead, he just lays his problem before the one being in all existence who has the power to fix it, and no one can stop him. Now, complaints are sometimes justified. This one was. Saul was completely wrong. David was in the right. He had never betrayed Saul in any way. He had never brought any of this on himself. But sometimes we respond in bitterness if our position is right, don't we? How can this be? This shouldn't be. But David isn't doing that. He's taking his problem to God rather than complaining in bitter unbelief. He's trusting that God knows how to work this out, and David wants to work it out with him. There's no rebellion in this kind of complaining. What there is intimacy. David's taking his trouble to someone whom he trusts. He's being open and honest. He recognizes that God knows his heart, so he's not playing any games, pretending that he's not complaining, because right now I'm praying. He's determined to work it out with God. Now, this is the kind of intimacy that we should pursue with our Creator when we have trouble. You know, you don't tell your problems to just everybody, right? I mean, you might proclaim your aches and pains to the world. Many do. You might proclaim your surface level complaints to anyone who will listen for as long as they'll listen. But when it gets down to what really disturbs you, and to the core issue that is really bothering you, to the thing that makes you feel the most vulnerable, you don't tell anybody. Unless you really trust them. And so most people don't ever tell anybody that stuff, right? But David takes that stuff to the God whom he trusts. We should be able and we should be ready to approach God very directly with any concern that we have. Not in rebellion, but in intimate trust. We know he knows, and we know we can lay this before him and get it figured out. So pray fervently, pray intimately, and then pray hopefully. Look at the first part of verse 3. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, you knew my path. He's speaking to God. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, you, God, knew my path. Now here, David's understanding of the nature and character of God has a profound effect on the way he prays and on his confidence as he faces this trouble. He knows that God knows his limits. He knows that God is attentive to his needs and to his abilities. He recognizes that God is aware of his enemies and of what they're doing. And he knows that God has not failed David in any way. Nothing has slipped past. Does that kind of knowledge comfort you? When you're in trouble, does it help to remember that God knows where you are? I had somebody tell me that one time. I was really stirred up. I had been through a really bad situation. It was people trouble. And, you know, you just get all stirred up inside. And this guy just says, you know what? God knows where you are. And I went, well, yeah. But I wasn't thinking about that right now. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, you knew my path. God knows where you are. When you're at your wit's end, when you're fainting under the weight of the problem, when your discouragement seems to overwhelm you, God knows where you are. He knows your path. He knows the way that you're going. He knows the way that you need to go. He knows. He's intimately acquainted with your trouble, with your enemies, with all of the ramifications of the circumstances, more so than we can ever be. And he knows how to take care of it better than we can know. And he knows what he's accomplishing in you, though you don't know. So those are very helpful things to remember in the midst of trouble. Even when you're overwhelmed, God knows where you are. Now, that kind of confident faith comes only to those who know what God is like, who know his character so that we trust him. If you don't really get what God is like, if it's really just kind of surface and shallow, you're really a Christian, but you don't have much knowledge of these things, and you're long past the immediate excitement of having been converted, and trouble comes, you can't think of this. Most people can't, in the middle of the emotional turmoil. You need to already know it. And David does. He knows what God is like. He knows that God is absolutely trustworthy, that he is all-powerful, that he's never going to fail us, and that he knows right where we are. Pray fervently, pray intimately, pray hopefully. Number four, pray realistically. I think sometimes people think that we're not supposed to admit or acknowledge problems in our prayer. That it's somehow unfaithful to be struggling. And if we were to say to God, of all people, that we're struggling, then, oh wow, that would just make it worse, right? That's how people often think. Sometimes Christians get the notion that admitting that problems make us struggle is a demonstration of unbelief. And this example from David's life teaches us that just the opposite is true. We can and should articulate the realistic details as we go to God in prayer. If it's bothering you, it's fair game for your prayer time. Talk to him about it. Work it out there. Look at the second half of verse 3 and verse 4. David says, in the way where I walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see, for there is no one who regards me. There is no escape for me. No one cares for my soul. That sounds kind of depressing, doesn't it? You're supposed to say that stuff in prayer? I mean, is that just whining or what, you know? In the way where I walk, they've hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see. There's no one who regards me. There's no escape for me. No one cares for my soul. There is no value in pretending that you don't have a problem. It's not like God doesn't know. So again, David is taking every detail to the God whom he trusts. Now here, he includes mentioning, I mean, he's at least alluding to certain people in his prayers in a way that he might not otherwise mention them, in the way that you might not be comfortable mentioning other people in your prayers, but he's talking about his enemies. They've hidden a trap for me. There are enemies of God who make themselves your enemies because you love him. And so David just acknowledges before God that there's a problem and that it's bothering him. There are people who are trying to kill him. No one is coming to his aid. No one seems to care. No one regards him. Everybody thinks he's a loser, in other words. You know, he's out there. He's been anointed king already for a long time, but Saul's still wearing the crown and sitting on the throne, and David's living out there in the desert, running for his life. No one has regard for him. This is real. And David's being realistic about it. There's no sense playing any games. If it's bothering you, talk to God about it. David acknowledges that people are active in trying to harm him. He acknowledges that the other people in Israel are just indifferent to his needs. They just think he's not a factor at all. That's kind of hard to take, isn't it? Who are you? You don't matter. That's how they thought of him. And then there were still others who cared for him in an emotional sense, but had no ability to care for him in a practical sense. They couldn't give any care, like Jonathan, Saul's son. He cared, but he couldn't care. He was concerned, but he couldn't do anything about it. The best he did was get David to run for his life. That was about all he could do. David just acknowledges all of this. He speaks openly of his concerns. Now, in this, there's an important mindset that is manifest. David recognizes that people cannot help with his real needs. People cannot meet your needs. And admitting that fact before God is not harmful. If you run to people in the midst of your trouble, it just adds to the problem, right? If we face reality in our prayer and we're just honest before God, it actually helps us. We should pray fervently, intimately, hopefully, realistically. Number five, pray attentively. Now, I mean by this that your attention is to be on God in your prayer. Sounds kind of obvious, doesn't it? When you pray, you should be thinking about God, right? So, that's just not a good sound. That has to mean something's wrong, right? All right, so we're saying pray attentively and be attentive to God in your prayer. Now, that sounds obvious at first, but I suggest that if you listen to your prayers, you might find that this is not always the case. That instead of being focused on God as the primary thing, you're focused on yourself. Me, 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 me. Or you're focused on other people. And God is in something of a secondary role sometimes, even when Christians pray. But look at verses 5 and 6. It says, I cried out to you, O Lord. I said, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Give heed to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Now, David is putting his attention where it should be. He puts it the only place where it'll do any good. He's very determined to focus on God in his prayers. Although he's mentioned himself, God is primary. He mentions his trouble, but his focus is more on God than on his trouble. He mentions other people, but his focus is more on God than on other people. David is not fixed on friends or enemies. He's not stuck on problems or solutions that he might imagine. You ever make your list of solutions to God, and that's all you can think about? God, you could do it this way, you could do it this way, you could do it this way. He's not doing that. He's looking to God alone as the one who can sort it all out, as the one that he trusts. Number six, pray specifically. I think sometimes Christian prayer is so general that it almost means nothing at all. Look how David gets specific. Look at verse 6 again. Give heed to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. And then verse 7, bring my soul out of prison. Now there are two things that David asks for specifically here. He mentions physical deliverance in verse 6. Deliver me from my persecutors, they're too strong for me. There's nothing wrong with asking for this, for physical deliverance. We do need to ask for it with the realization that it's not the ultimate goal in life. We all eventually die. If the Lord doesn't come back pretty soon, we're gone. That's just how God designed all of this to work. And so our purpose, God's purpose, is not to leave us eternally in this mess. Sometimes people pray for deliverance as if God's real purpose was that you never die, but eternally live in this clutter of sin that pervades this world. That's not God's purpose. So we ask for physical deliverance because God's given us that desire to live, and we should go to Him with that, but always with the realization that there is appointed to every man a day to stand before Him in judgment. Our time of death is appointed. David eventually died, though he prayed this way. So we ask in faith, we leave the details to God, but there's nothing wrong with asking for physical deliverance. There's a more important category, though, and this is the second thing that David mentions here very specifically. He asks for something in the spiritual realm. In verse 7, he says, bring my soul out of prison. David is intimately concerned about his immaterial being. Bring my soul out of prison. Think about what that means. Have you seen, as I have seen, souls that are in bondage while the bodies are very comfortable? Some of the most beautiful, most healthy, most wealthy people who get to indulge physically in every delight this world has to offer, some of those are in the most bondage of the soul. On the other hand, you can have your soul set free anywhere, anytime, any place, any circumstance. David says, bring my soul out of prison, whatever else happens. Be specific in your prayer and pray for stuff like this. Don't leave this out. We should be concerned for our physical circumstances. We should take that to God, but we should be even more concerned about our spiritual circumstances and look to Him for the power and the supply that we need. All right, number 7, pray expectantly. This is the hard one. When you pray, do you look for something to happen? I mean, do you grow increasingly excited as your prayer time goes on because more and more now you think, I'm getting closer to what God is going to do in answer to this prayer? Do you expect it to do something? Is there in you an excited anticipation? Look at verse 7 again. Bring my soul out of prison so that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me. David expects results from this prayer. He's looking beyond his trouble, and he's looking beyond his immediate interaction with God on the subject of his trouble. He believes God is trustworthy and that God is in control and that God has determined good for him, and so he's looking to that good result, and he expects it to come. And so he summarizes it beautifully in verse 7. So that I may give thanks to your name. David knows that he's going to glorify God and thank him that this circumstance in the cave, running for your life, this isn't all that there is for David. There will come a day when he can rejoice openly and be delighted and give thanks and glorify God's name. And he knows it. Can you pray that way in the middle of your trouble? David also says, so that the righteous will surround me. Bring my soul out of bondage so that the righteous will surround me. Now, at the time of his prayer, there aren't any righteous surrounding him. Nobody's caring about him. He's already complained about that, right? He feels very isolated, very much alone. The other people who are around him when he's running from Saul are also people who are kind of outlaws. For whatever reason, some righteous, some not, but he's very isolated, but he expects a day to come at the end of this trial when many righteous people will join him in glorifying God. That's going to happen when God delivers him out of this trouble. Now, in the last line of the psalm, David proclaims the reason that he has that kind of hope. Or maybe this is just another expression of that hope. But he says, for you will deal bountifully with me. What an expression of confidence in God. When you consider where he was when he made it, what his life looked like when he made that statement, what it had to have felt like when he made that statement, what a beautiful expression of confidence. How different is this from what I heard growing up in rural northwest Georgia? Oh, hon, it'll all work out. It's a whole different kind of confidence, isn't it? How can he say this? For you will deal bountifully with me. How can you know that? How does this guy know that? In those circumstances that he has described and that we get more info on in 1 Samuel, David knows from the character of God already demonstrated in his life personally that God has purposed good for him. And God has redeemed him. He's not going to forsake his redeemed. He's already received salvation, which includes a promise of a bountiful future in which nothing is lacking and it goes on forever and ever in perfect harmony. He's already got that. David had also received specific promises regarding the kingdom. That's what infuriated Saul so much. David apparently figures that God is going to be stronger than Saul and that this is going to end well for him, which it did. But even in his worst trouble, he didn't lose sight of the fact that God had already proven his determination to do good to David. And so he can look beyond the trouble and realize there's going to be more good. And that even this is working God's good purpose in me. If God has determined to deal bountifully with you, he's going to do it. And if you're his child, he's determined it, and he will do it. Now, this is the kind of confidence that a redeemed person ought to be able to express, even in the middle of trouble, Particularly if we stop and think about it for a minute, or we read a psalm like this one and we go, you know what? That's right. What was I worried about? God can take me through this. And there's a future that anybody would envy who doesn't also have it. I've got everything coming to me. Now, because of that, we should be able to pray expectantly. We should be able to expect that God is going to do wonderful things in our lives, no matter what's going on right now. And even if what's going on right now is lifelong or makes our lives short, this hope still is ours if we're in Christ. Any problem, we should be able to look beyond and say, for you will deal bountifully with me. Not just that he can, that he will. He's already proven it. So there are my seven characteristics. I mean, I got those words by looking at this, and that's what I thought of. Maybe you look at this psalm and you think of other descriptive words for this kind of prayer. What do you think? You got any ideas on what else we might say about this prayer? Somebody give me another one-word summary. Thumbs up or a thumbs down. How about insistent? A couple of people actually did that. That was good. You ought to get the gold stars. Thank you for the encouragement. How about worshipful? Is that a word for you? You can just nod this time. We don't want to wear it out. Thank you. Verse 2, David pours out his complaints before God. Why do you think people hesitate to do that? Or do you? Maybe you don't. Some people do. Why do you think people hesitate to just lay it all out there in their prayer?
Sometimes we
sometimes if we articulate it, then we realize how selfish that thing was in us, or maybe even a little bit shallow. And I think that's one of the most compelling reasons why you Because if it is shallow, or if it is silly, or if it is selfish, you need to find out. Many times as you pray about something, you realize, you know, I just need to let go of this. And that's good. That's why you can't hold back. Any other thoughts on why we might?
I think we might think that it's wrong to complain to God, you know, that God has us in this for a reason, and that we shouldn't complain. You know, we tell our kids to keep complaining, you know, all those kind of things. But I think we need to be honest with God and let God know what is bothering us. And, you know, as long as you have the right attitude, that you trust God in the midst of whatever is going on, that it's fine.
Does know what's bothering us, but if we articulate it, then oftentimes we figure out what the real issue is. And God doesn't answer our proud posturing nearly as well as he does our humble praying. So I found it much more effective in prayer if I say, okay, God, I am really having a hard time with this. I know what I ought to do. The problem is I just don't want to. And I need your help. He answers that so much more often than, Lord, help me to be diligent and faithful. And I'm really just trying not to have to say it. So, yeah. That's good. Anybody else?
Chris? Just on the belief. I think that it's not really going to make a difference if you do pray for all the things that he wants in that relationship.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You see this a lot of times in the way people pray or talk about prayer. It's just something we do. It's something we do to make us better. But it's not. It's not trusting God that drives it. And we could fall into that too. Jeremy?
Back to what you said just a second ago, and it sort of hit me, made me realize I've been guilty of praying that way before. Lord, help me to be diligent. Help me to be better, you know, and just use these words to sort of skirt the issue, because in my mind I think, well, the Lord can read my mind. He knows what issue I'm talking about here, instead of just voicing it to him in prayer, because you do find yourself skittish in that. But that's, I like what you said. If you'll just say, look, this is what I need to do. I don't want to do it. Will you help me with this? And getting more specific with the Lord, instead of just skirting around the issue, thinking, well, he can read my mind, he knows what I'm thinking. Yeah, maybe we need to voice that out a little more.
Yeah, and it's not the, you know, it's not the praying for diligence or for faithfulness. It's not those big broad terms that's the problem. Right. It's using those terms to avoid having to confess our sin in prayer. If diligence is an issue in my life, and I need to say, God, help me to be diligent, and here's how I'm not doing it, and here's help me to see why I don't seem to get it done. But sometimes we use the big words to avoid dealing with what's really going on. And that's the issue. We're being so specific. If we're being selfish, it shows it up. If it's sin in our hearts, we have to think about it well enough to get there. Years and years ago, I read the autobiography of Lee Iacocca. It was an interesting sort of secular book to read. And he said one of the problems he had imagining other people is that they would say, well, I know what I'm trying to say. And he made this really, and I read this thing years and years ago, the first time this has occurred to me. He said, no, you don't. If you knew what you were trying to say, you could say it. Now go away and figure it out and come back and we'll have another meeting. Oh, wow. If I can't put it into words, I haven't thought through it. I don't know what the issues are. If I can't, that works in business. You need to take to your boss something concise, but it works in your prayer time too. What are you trying to say? Using the spiritual buzzwords and never really saying anything? Or are you getting down to what it's complaining with not in bitterness and unbelief, but in, God, I need help with this. I'm having a hard time with this. That kind of complaining from a humble heart, a right heart, that helps in prayer. And I think we shy away from it for a myriad of reasons. Y'all mentioned some really good ones. Right quick, before we run out of time, tell me, how do you think David manages to expect these good things that he states at the end of his prayer? He's very specific. They're the exact opposite of what he's experiencing when he prays. How does he manage to genuinely believe that? How do you pray in that kind of faith? You look like you're ready to talk for the second time.
He knows God.
He knows God. Yeah. Knowledge of God's character. We can trust him. You can't work this up, can you? You cannot generate from within yourself the kind of hope he expresses at the end of this song. That hope comes out of what you really think. If you really think he's trustworthy, then you can trust him. Anybody want to add to that? Any other issue there that feeds into this ability to expect good things? Study on prayer started yesterday, meeting once a month. I think there's a reading for that. It was something I wrote this week. I said, you don't mean if you lost a pencil, you would ask God for help? And the guy that he said that to said, oh, yeah, I would. I would. He got really excited about it. That was in our book, right? Okay. Because I read some other stuff. I thought, you know, that's good. A little stuff. But having that attitude, it's not something that you just talk yourself into. It comes from knowing God, knowing his character. It also comes from knowing his purpose. And that's key in what David says. He knows that God has purposed good things for him. If you don't know that, God has determined good things for his children. If you don't know that, it's hard to be this hopeful. I'm out of time. Thank you for some good feedback on the video.